This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Tales of Wonder and Imagination, written by Stephen King, Neil Gaiman, George R. R. Martin, Joyce Carol Oates, Susanna Clark, Lawrence Block, Tanith Lee, Peter S. Beagle, Graham Joyce, John Crowley, Charles DeLint, Ellen Datlow, editor. Narrated by Teresa DeBerry, Jeremy Arthur, and Cynthia Barrett.
Introduction. Ellen Datlow. What is it about cats? Why do they lend themselves to fiction so easily? There have been numerous anthologies of cat stories, several of them multi-volume series. There is no other animal about which writers from all genres seem to be obsessed. Mystery, horror, science fiction, and fantasy stories have been written about cats. It's possible that felines, thought to be domesticated by happenstance rather than intent, are considered more mysterious and thus more interesting to write about than other animals. Canines are pretty upfront about their feelings. They're considered to be loyal, obedient, and cheerful. Dogs, the oldest domesticated animal, have anthropomorphized themselves, become more like people. Cats have done very little of that. They are still strangers in the house. The cat does what it wants and goes its own way, which conjures up the darker images of willfulness, self-interest, and mystery. It's said that one is a dog person or a cat person. I've been both. I grew up with a wonderful Cocker Spaniel I adored and took exploring in the suburban woods across from where I lived. I don't recall seeing many cats. All I knew of these mysterious creatures was that they chased and ate mice in the weird, silent, black-and-white, very primitive Farmer Gray cartoons of my childhood, and that my aunt living in West Germany would write regular letters to me reporting on her cat's antics. It, and as a result she, were always in trouble with the neighbors for its skill at killing birds. It wasn't until I moved to Manhattan that I acquired, through a roommate, my first cat. The roommate moved in immediately, brought home two kittens, and then fled Manhattan after a couple of months, leaving me with one kitten, because her parents wouldn't let her take both back to Ann Arbor. I was suddenly a cat owner, soon acquiring a second, older cat, who lived to be 23-plus, and was soon faced with my own dead or dying birds. A roof adjoining my apartment allowed my cat's limited roaming area. Since then, I've always owned cats. Or have they owned me? The stories herein are culled from anthologies, magazines, and collections, most published from 1980 to 2009. A few, such as the Lewis Carroll excerpt and the John Crowley and Stephen King stories in the late 70s. There are stories in which cats are the heroes, and some in which they're the villains. There are domestic cats, tigers, lions, mythical part-cat beings, people transformed into cats, and cats transformed into people. There's science fiction, fantasy, mystery, horror, and even one mainstream cat story. And yes, a few cute cats. This is not my first cat anthology. I edited Twists of the Tale in 1996. It consisted of mostly original horror stories, three of them reprinted in this book. Through the Looking Glass. Excerpt. Lewis Carroll. One thing was certain, that the white kitten had had nothing to do with it. It was the black kitten's fault entirely. For the white kitten had been having its face washed by the old cat for the last quarter of an hour, and bearing it pretty well, considering. So you see that it couldn't have had any hand in the mischief. The way Dinah washed her children's faces was this. First, she held the poor thing down by its ear with one paw, and then with the other paw she rubbed its face all over the wrong way, beginning at the nose, and just now, as I said, she was hard at work on the white kitten, which was lying quite still and trying to purr, no doubt feeling that it was all meant for its good. But the black kitten had been finished with earlier in the afternoon, and so, while Alice was sitting curled up in a corner of the great armchair, half talking to herself and half asleep, the kitten had been having a grand game of romps with the ball of worsted Alice had been trying to wind up, and had been rolling it up and down till it had all come undone again. And there it was, spread over the hearth rug, all knots and tangles, with the kitten running after its own tail in the middle. "Oh, you wicked little thing!" cried Alice, catching up the kitten and giving it a little kiss to make it understand that it was in disgrace. "Really, Dinah ought to have taught you better manners. You ought, Dinah, you know you ought," she added, looking reproachfully at the old cat, and speaking in as cross a voice as she could manage. And then she scrambled back into the armchair, taking the kitten and the worsted with her, and began winding up the ball again. But she didn't get on very fast, as she was talking all the time, sometimes to the kitten and sometimes to herself. Kitty sat very demurely on her knee, pretending to watch the progress of the winding, and now and then putting out one paw and gently touching the ball, as if it would be glad to help if it might. "Do you know what tomorrow is, Kitty?" Alice began. "You'd have guessed if you'd been up in the window with me. Only Dinah was making you tidy, so you couldn't. I was watching the boys getting in sticks for the bonfire, and it wants plenty of sticks, Kitty. Only it got so cold and it snowed so, they had to leave off. Never mind, Kitty, we'll go and see the bonfire tomorrow." Here, Alice wound two or three turns of the worsted round the kitten's neck, just to see how it would look. This led to a scramble, in which the ball rolled down upon the floor and yards of it got unwound again. "Do you know, I was so angry, Kitty," Alice went on, as soon as they were comfortably settled again. "When I saw all the mischief you had been doing, I was very nearly opening the window and putting you out into the snow. And you'd have deserved it, you little mischievous darling. What have you got to say for yourself? Now, don't interrupt me," she went on, holding up one finger. "I'm going to tell you all your faults. Number one, you squeaked twice while Dinah was washing your face this morning. Now, you can't deny it, Kitty. I heard you. What's that you say?" pretending that the kitten was speaking. "Her paw went into your eye. Well, that's your fault for keeping your eyes open. If you'd shut them tied up, it wouldn't have happened. Now, don't make any more excuses, but listen. Number two, you pulled Snowdrop away by the tail just as I had put down the saucer of milk before her. What? You were thirsty, were you? How do you know she wasn't thirsty too? Now for number three. You unwound every bit of the worsted while I wasn't looking. That's three faults, Kitty, and you've not been punished for any of them yet. You know I'm saving up all your punishments for Wednesday week. Suppose they had saved up all my punishments. She went on, talking more to herself than the kitten. What would they do at the end of a year? I should be sent to prison, I suppose, when the day came. Or, let me see, suppose each punishment was to be going without a dinner. Then, when the miserable day came, I should have to go without 50 dinners at once. Well, I shouldn't mind that much. I'd far rather go without them than eat them. Do you hear the snow against the window panes, Kitty? How nice and soft it sounds, just as if someone was kissing the window all over outside. I wonder if the snow loves the trees and fields, that it kisses them so gently. And then it covers them up snug, you know, with a white quilt, and perhaps it says, "Go to sleep, darlings, till the summer comes again." And when they wake up in the summer, Kitty, they dress themselves all in green and dance about. Whenever the wind blows, oh, that's very pretty, cried Alice, dropping the ball of worsted to clap her hands. And I do so wish it was true. I'm sure the woods look sleepy in the autumn when the leaves are getting brown. Kitty, can you play chess? Now don't smile, my dear. I'm asking it seriously, because when we were playing just now, you watched just as if you understood it. And when I said check, you purred. Well, it was a nice check, Kitty, and really I might have won if it hadn't been for that nasty knight that came wiggling down among my pieces. Kitty, dear, let's pretend. And here I wish I could tell you half the things Alice used to say, beginning with her favourite phrase. Let's pretend. She had had quite a long argument with her sister only the day before, all because Alice had begun with, "Let's pretend we're kings and queens." And her sister, who liked being very exact, had argued that they couldn't because there were only two of them. And Alice had been reduced at last to say, "Well, you can be one of them then, and I'll be all the rest." And once she had really frightened her old nurse by shouting suddenly in her ear, "Nurse, do let's pretend that I'm a hungry hyena and you're a bone." But this is taking us away from Alice's speech to the kitten. "Let's pretend that you're the Red Queen, Kitty. Do you know, I think if you sat up and folded your arms, you'd look exactly like her. Now do try. There's a dear." And Alice got the Red Queen off the table and set it up before the kitten as a model for it to imitate. However, the thing didn't succeed, principally. Alice said because the kitten wouldn't fold its arms properly. So, to punish it, she held it up to the looking-glass, that it might see how sulky it was. "And if you're not good directly," she added, "I'll put you through into Looking-Glass House. How would you like that? Now, if you'll only attend, Kitty, and not talk so much, I'll tell you all my ideas about Looking-Glass House. First, there's the room you can see through the glass. That's just the same as our drawing room, only the things go the other way. I can see all of it when I get upon a chair. All but the bit behind the fireplace. Oh, I do so wish I could see that bit. I so much want to know whether they've a fire in the winter. You never can tell. You know, unless our fire smokes, and then smoke comes up in that room too. But that may be only pretense, just to make it look as if they had a fire. Well then, the books are something like our books, only the words go the wrong way. I know that because I've held up one of our books to the glass, and then they hold up one in the other room. How would you like to live in Looking Glass House, Kitty? I wonder if they'd give you milk in there. Perhaps Looking Glass milk isn't good to drink. But, oh, Kitty, now we've come to the passage. You can just see a little peep of the passage in Looking Glass House. If you leave the door of our drawing room wide open, and it's very like our passage as far as you can see, only you know it may be quite different on beyond. Oh, Kitty, how nice it would be if we could only get through into Looking Glass House. I'm sure it's got, oh, such beautiful things in it. Let's pretend there's a way of getting through into it somehow, Kitty. Let's pretend the glass has got all soft like gauze so that we can get through. Why, it's turning into a sort of mist now, I declare. It'll be easy enough to get through. She was up on the chimney piece while she said this, though she hardly knew how she had got there. And certainly, the glass was beginning to melt away, just like a bright, silvery mist.
No heaven will not ever heaven be. A.R. Moreland.
A.R. Moreland's short fiction, under her own name and three pen names, has been published or is forthcoming in over 120 different magazines, anthologies, and webzines in the United States, Canada, and parts of Europe. Her stories are collected in Smothered Dolls. She lives in the Midwest with a house full of cat children. Moreland's love of cats shows in her portrait of a man and his cats. When I first read the story, I originally bought it for my cat horror anthology, Twists of the Tale. I was so taken by Hobart Gurney and Katz's Cats that I called the author to ask if Gurney was based on a real person. The answer is yes and no. Moreland says that the character was inspired by a real barn advertising painter who only painted text, not pictures of cats. All of the cats depicted in the story are based on actual cats the author has owned. There are no ordinary cats. Colette.
Not too long ago, it wasn't too uncommon for someone driving down Little Egypt Way, where southern Illinois merges into Kentucky, close to the Cumberland River, to see, oh, maybe 5-6 Katz's chewing tobacco barn advertisements within a 3 or 4 hour drive. In his prime, Hobart Gurney was a busy man. Now, if a person wants to see Gurney's handiwork, they have to drive or fly out to New York City, or, if they're lucky, catch one of the traveling exhibitions of his work, if the exhibitors can get insurance. After all, Gurney was sort of the Jackson Pollock of the barn art world. He worked with what paints he had, with an eye toward getting the job done fast and getting his pay even quicker once he was finished. So those cut-out chunks of barn wall need to be babied like they were fashioned out of spun sugar and spiderwebs, and not just flaking paint on sometimes rotting planks. Someone once told me that the surviving Katz's barn signs had to be treated with the same sort of preservation methods as the relics unearthed from Egyptian tombs. Now that would have tickled old Hobart Gurney's fancy, as he might have put it. Oh, not so much the preservation part, but the Egyptian aspect of it all. For Gurney did far more than paint Katz's chewing tobacco signs for a living, not to mention for a good part of his life, period. He lived for his Katz's cats. Died for them, too. But that's another story. One you won't read about in any of those books filled with photographs of Gurney's barn signs, or hear about on those PBS or arts and entertainment specials on his life and work. But the story rivals any ever told about the cat-worshipping Egyptians, especially since Hobart knew his cats weren't gods, but loved them anyhow, and because they loved him back. When I first met Hobart Gurney, I thought he was just another one of those old men you see in just about every small town in the rural heartland. You've seen them, old men of less than average height, wearing pants that are too big in the waist and too long in the leg, held up by suspenders or belts snugged up so tight they can hardly breathe, with spines like shallow seas and shoulders pinched protectively around their collarbones. The kind of old men who wear two clean baseball caps, or maybe tam-o'-shanters topped with fluffy pom-poms, and no matter how often they shave, they always seem to have an eighth-inch-long near-transparent stubble dusting their parchment cheeks. The kind who shuffle and pause near curbs, then stop and stand there, lost in thought, once they step off the curb. The kind of old man who's all but invisible until he hawks phlegm on the sidewalk, not out of spite, but because men did that sort of thing without thinking years ago. I was adjusting the shutter speed on my camera when I heard him hawk and spit not 2 feet away from me, making that irritating noise that totally blows one's concentration. And it was one of those days when the clouds kept moving in front of the sun every few seconds, totally changing the amount of available natural light hitting the side of the barn whose painted side I was trying to capture. Without thinking, I looked back over my shoulder and grumped, "You mind? I'm trying to adjust my camera." The old man just stood there, hands shoved past the wrists into his trouser pockets, a fine dark dribble of tobacco spittle still clinging to the side of his stubbled chin, staring mildly at me with hat-bill-shaded pale blue eyes. After a few false fluttering starts of his chapped-lipped mouth, he said,
"No self-respecting cat ever wants to be a model. You have to sort of sneak up on them when they ain't paying you no mind."
"Uh-huh," I said, turning my attention back to the 6-foot-tall cat painted next to the neatly lettered legend, "Katz's Chewing Tobacco. It's the Cat's Meow." This Katz's cat was one of the finest I'd seen yet. Unlike other cat logo signs, like the Chessie Railroad cat, for instance, every Katz's cat was different. Different color, different pose, sometimes even more than one cat per barn sign. And this one was a masterpiece. A gray tiger, the kind of animal whose fur you know would be soft to the touch, with each multi-hued hair tipped with just enough white to give the whole cat an aura-like sheen, and a softly thick neck that told the world that this cat was an unneutered male, old enough to have sired a few litters of kittens, but not old enough to be piss-mean or battle-scarred. A young male, maybe 2, 3 years old. And his eyes were gentle, too, trusting eyes, of hazy green, touched with a hint of yellow along the oval pupils, over a grayish-pink nose and a mouth covering barely visible fang tips. He was resting on his side, so all four of his paw pads were visible, each one colored that between gray and pink color. That's a bit of each, yet something not at all on the artist's color wheel. And his amber-ringed tail was curled up and over his hind feet, resting in a relaxed curl over his hind paws. But something in his sweet face told a person that this cat would jump right up into your arms if you only patted your chest and said, "Come here." But, considering that this cat was mostly gray, and the barn behind him was weathering fast, I had to make sure the shutter speed was adjusted so, or I'd never capture this particular cat's cat. Not the way the clouds were rolling in faster and faster.
"Don't look like fellow wants his picture took today,"
the tobacco-spitting old man said helpfully, as I missed yet another split second of sun opportunity to capture the likeness of the reclining cat. That did it. Letting my camera flop down against my chest by the strap, I turned around and asked, "Do you own this barn? Am I supposed to pay you for taking a picture or what?" The old man looked at me meekly, his bill-shaded eyes wide with hurt as he sat around a glob of chaw.
"I already got my pay for that, and but I suppose you could say it's my cat."
When he said that, all my irritation and impatience melted into a soggy feeling of shame, mingled with heart-thumping awe. This baggy-trousered old man had to be Hobart Gurney, the sign painter responsible for all of the Katz's tobacco signs dotting barns throughout southern Illinois and western Kentucky. The man who was still painting such signs up until a couple of years ago, stopping only when old age made it difficult for him to get up and down the ladders. I'd seen that profile about him on CNN a few years ago, when he was painting his last or next-to-last Katz's sign. But most old men tend to look alike, especially when decked out in the ubiquitous uniform of a baseball cap and paint-splattered overalls. And, at any rate, the work had impressed me more than the man who created it. Putting out my hand, I said, "Hey, sorry about what I said. I didn't mean it like that. It's just that I only have so many days of vacation left, and the weather hasn't exactly been cooperative." Gurney's hand was dry and firm. He shook hands until I had to withdraw my aching hand, as he replied,
"No offense, Mint. No offense taken. I expect fellow will wait a whiles until the clouds see fit to cooperate with you. He's a patient one, is fella, but shy round strangers."
The way he said fella, I knew the name should be capitalized, instead of it being a generic nomenclature for the animal at hand. Judging from the way the clouds scudded across the sun, I figured that fella was in for a good long wait, so I motioned to the rental car parked a few yards away from the barn, inviting Gurney to share one of the cans of Pepsi in my backseat cooler. Gurney's trousers made a raspy rubbing noise when he walked, not unlike the sound a cat's tongue makes when it licks your bare arm. And when he was speaking in close quarters, his tobacco-laced breath was sort of cat-fetid, too, all wild-smelling and warm. The old man positioned himself half in and half out of my car, so he could see his fella clearly, while still keeping his body in the relative warmth of my car. Between noisy slurps of soda, he told me,
"Like I said, no self-respecting cat aims to model for you. So's the only way to get around it is to make your own cat. Memory's the best model they is."
I almost choked on my Pepsi when he said that. All along, I'd assumed that Gurney had used whatever barn cats were wandering around him for his inspiration. But to create such accurate, personable cats from memory and imagination.
"Funny thing is, when I was hired on to work for Katz back in the 30s, all they was interested in was getting their name out in front of the public, in as big letters as possible. That I added Katz to the Katz's signs was my idea. Didn't get paid no extra for doing it neither. But it seemed natural, you see. And it did get folks' attention. Besides, them cats, they kept me company while I was working. Gets mighty lonely up on that ladder, with the wind snaking down your shirt collar, and no one to talk to up that high. Was sort of like when I was a boy, mucking out my pa's barn, and the barn cats, they'd come snaking round my legs, purring and sometimes jumping straight up onto my shoulders, so they'd hitch a free ride while I was working. Only I didn't get round to giving too many of them cats names, you see, 'cause they was always coming or going or getting cow-crushed. Oh, them cows didn't mean no harm, see? It's just they was so big and them cats too small when they try snuggling up with 'em on cold winter nights. But I sure do enjoy their company. Now you may laugh at this, but—"
Here Gurney lowered his voice, even though there was no one else around to hear him but me, and the huge painted fella resting on the side of the abandoned barn.
"When I was a young'un, and even a not-so-young'un, I had me this dream. I wanted to be small, like a cat, for oh, maybe a night or so. Just long enough for me to snuggle down with a whole litter full of cats, 4 or 5 of 'em, all of us same-sized and warm in the hay. And we'd tangle our legs and whatnot in a warm pile, and they'd lick my face and then burrow their heads under my chin or mine under theirs, and we'd sleep for a time. Nothing better for the insomnia than to rest with a cat purring in your ears. 'Tis true. Don't need none of them sleeping pills when you got yourself a cat. That's why I took the Katz's tobacco job when I heard of it, even though I wasn't too keen on heights. Course, it being the Depression was a powerful motivator, too, but the name Katz was just too good to pass by, and them not minding when I dickied with their adverts was heaven made for me, too. Struck me funny, when them television fellers interviewed me and all, when I was painting the little girls.
Gurney's words made me remember the album of Katz's signs I kept locked in the trunk of the car. Not my only set, but a spare album I used for reference, especially when coming across a barn I may have photographed before, under different lighting or seasonal circumstances. Too excited to speak, I got out of the back seat and hurried for the trunk, while Gurney kept on talking about the pup reporter who'd interviewed him for that 3-minute interview.
"And he didn't even ask me what the cat's names was, like it didn't matter none to—"
"Were these the little girls?" I asked as I flipped through the album pages, until I found the dry-mounted snapshot of one of the most elaborate Katz's signs. 4 kittens snuggled together in a hollowed-out bed of straw, their pointed little faces curious yet subtly wary, as if they'd all burrow into the straw if you took one step closer to them. Clearly a litter of barn kittens, even if you discounted the straw bedding. These weren't Christmas card and yarn balls kittens, cavorting live like Dakin kittens for a Madison Avenue artist, but feral-type kittens, the kind you'd be lucky to coax close enough to sniff your fingers before they'd run off to hide in the farthest corners of the manure-scented barn where they were born. The kind of kitten who'd grown up slack-thin and long-tailed, slinking around corners like a fleshed-out shadow, or coming up to you from behind, as if sizing up whether or not to take a sharp-clawed swipe at your shoe before running for cover. The kind of cat you know will get kittened out before she's 3 years old, winding up saggy-bellied and defensive by the time she's 4. But when Gurney saw the 8x10 enlargement, his face lit up and his puckered lips stretched out into a broad grin, exposing what my own grandfather used to call dime-store choppers of an astonishing Chiclets gum uniform squareness and off-whiteness.
"You took a picture of my little girls. Usually they're tricky ones, on account of Prissy and Mish-Mish looking so much alike. But you caught 'em, by gummy. Got them in just the right light."
Wait, let me get this down," I said, reaching over the seat for the notebook and pen resting on the front passenger seat. "Now, which one is which?" His face, glowing with the kind of pride most men his age took in showing off pictures of their grandchildren, or even great-grandkids, Gurney pointed at each kitten in turn, stroking their chemically captured images with a tender, affectionate forefinger, as if chucking each under her painted chin.
"This is Smokey, the tiger gray, and here's Prissy. See how dainty she looks, with them fox-narrow eyes and little points on her ears? And right next to her is Mish-Mish, even though they're both calicos. Mishy's a little more patchy-colored than usual."
"Mish-Mish?" I asked, not knowing how he'd come up with that name. Gurney's answer surprised and touched me.
"Got that name from the Milwaukee Journal green sheet, where they put all their funnies and little offbeat articles. Was an article about the Middle East, and it mentioned how them Arabs like cats so much, and how their version of kitty-kitty was Mish-Mish, which is their lingo for peach color on account of most of their strays being sort of peachy orange. See how Mish-Mish's face has got that big splotch of peach on it? Oh, I know we're not supposed to care what them Arab folks think, on account of them being the enemy or whatnot, but you can't fault a people who care so much for their cats too much. Heard tell the Egyptians worshipped their cats like gods. Done up their pets as mummies, the whole shebang. So's I don't even mind when their descendants say they hate us, long as they take care of their cats. 'Cause a man who can hate a cat can't much like hisself, I says."
I had to laugh at that. Before Gurney could go on, I quoted Mark Twain from memory. "If man could be crossed with the cat, it would improve the man, but deteriorate the cat." Now it was Gurney's time to laugh, until he spittle-flecked his shirt collar before he went on.
"Anyhow, next to Mish-Mish is Tinker, only you can't tell from looking at her that she's a girl, on count of her only being 2 colors and all. But from personal experience, most gray cats with white feet I've seen's been girls. Don't know why that is. Sort of like how you never see a white cat with black feet and chest, like you see black cats with white socks and bibs. Funny how nature works that way, ain't it?"
Having told me the names of the little girls, which I duly wrote down in my notebook, Gurney began paging through the rest of the album, matching heretofore anonymous painted felines with the names that somehow made them real, at least to the man who created them. black-bodied and white-socked Ming, with his clear, clear green eyes and luxurious long fur with a couple of mats along the chest, Calico Beanie, with her rounded gray chin and owl-like yellow-green eyes, Dandelion Fuzzy Stan and Ollie, black-and-white tuxedo-patterned kittens, one obviously fatter, but both still too wobbly-limbed and tiny-eared to look anything but pick-me-up adorable. And too many more to remember offhand. Thank goodness I had many clean pages left in my notebook that afternoon. But once each cat was named, I could never again look at it as just another Katz's tobacco cat. For instance, knowing that Beanie was Beanie made her into a cat, one with a history and a personality. You just knew that she was full of beans when she was a kitten, getting into things, playing with her tail until she'd spun herself like a dime store top. And for a moment, Gurney's cats became more than pigment and imagination, not unlike the work of regular canvas easels and palette artists, or those natural-born billboard painters, the legendary ones who never needed to use those grid-like blueprints to create the advertisements. It was sad, really, how that reporter had missed out on the essence of Gurney's work. All the pup reporter seemed to be interested in was how long Gurney had been at it. As Gurney looked at the last of the barn pictures I'd taken and enlarged, he said shyly,
"I feel sorta humbled by this and all. It's like I was one of them art fart painter guys in a gallery instead of a regular working Joe. Though not that I'm not pleased, it's just... oh, I don't know. It just seems funny to have my cats all put in a book form, instead of them just being out where they are, in the open and all. Like they was suddenly domesticated, instead of being regular barn kitties."
I didn't know how to answer that. I realized that Gurney must be astute enough to realize that his signs were works of art. He may have been slightly inarticulate, and most likely unschooled, but he wasn't ignorant by any means. He was obviously in a quandary. On the one hand, he was from a time when work was simply something you got paid for, period. Yet on the other hand, the fact that he'd been interviewed on TV and caught me taking pictures of his efforts must have been an indication that his work was something special. He couldn't quite cope with having a fuss being made over something he'd considered to be paid labor. I gently lifted the book off his lap and placed it on the seat between us before saying, "I can empathize with you there. I work as an advertising photographer, taking pictures of products for clients, and when someone praises me for my composition or whatever, it can be a strange feeling, especially since I'm just a go-between when it comes to the product and the consumer." Gurney's watery, pale blue eyes were darting around as I spoke, and for a moment I was afraid that I was losing his attention. But instead he surprised me by saying,
"I think fella's lost his shyness. The sun's been shining for a good minute now."
Quickly, I got out of the car and positioned myself in front of the barn. True to Gurney's word, fella was no longer shy, but exposed in all his sunlit perfection against the sun-weathered barn. It's funny, but even though the lettering next to the cat was badly flaked, I could almost see every individual hair of the tomcat's fur. And behind me, Hobart Gurney took a noisy slurp of soda as he repeated, in the way of old men you see in every small town,
"Yes, sirree. My fella's not shy anymore."
I said goodbye to Gurney a couple of hours later, outside the adult daycare center and senior's apartment where he lived, without going in. I knew what his room must be like. Single bed, with a worn ripcord bedspread, some issues of Reader's Digest large print edition on the bedstand, and a doorless closet filled with not too many clothes hanging from those crochet-covered hangers. And most depressing of all, no animals at all to keep him company. It was the sort of place where they only bring in some puppies or kittens when the local newspaper editor wants a set of human interest pictures for the inner spread during a dull newsweek. Oldsters with animals on their Afghan-covered laps. Not the sort of place where suddenly small men snuggle with litters of barn cats in a bed of straw. With an almost comic formality, Gurney thanked me for the Pepsi and for letting me see the kitties in my album. I asked him if he got out much to see the signs in person, but instantly regretted my words when he nonchalantly spit at his feet before saying,
Don't get round much since I turned in my driver's license. My hands aren't as steady as they used to be it with a brush or with a steering wheel. Once I almost run over a cat crossing a back road and told myself, "This is it, Hobart," even though the cat, she got away okay. Wasn't worth the risk.
Not knowing what else to do, I opened the back door of the car and brought out the album. Gurney didn't want to take it at first, even though I assured him that I had another set of prints plus the negatives back in my studio in New York City. The way he brushed the outside of the album with his fingers, as if the imitation leather was soft tiger stripe fur, was almost too much for me. Knowing that I couldn't stay, couldn't see any more of this, I bid him farewell and left him standing in front of the Oldster's home, album of kitties in his hands. I know I should have done more, but what could I do? Really? I'd given him back his cats. I couldn't give him back his old life. And what he'd shared with me already hurt too much, especially his revelation of the smallness fantasy. I mean, how often do even people who are close to each other, like old friends or family, reveal such intimate, deeply needing things like that, especially without being asked to? Once you know things like that about a person, it gets a little hard to face them without feeling like you have a bought from a comic book ad pair of X-ray glasses capable of peering into their soul. Nobody should be that vulnerable to another living being, especially one they hardly know. A few days after I met Hobart Gurney, my vacation in the Midwest was over, and I returned to my studio to turn lifeless sample products into something potentially essential to people who didn't know they needed that thing until that month's issue of Vanity Fair or Cosmopolitan arrived in the mail, and they finally got around to paging through the magazine after getting home from work. Not that I felt responsible for turning the unknown into the essential. Even when I got to keep what I photographed, it didn't mean squat to me. I could appreciate my work, respect my better efforts, but I never gave a pet name to a bottle of men's cologne, if you get my drift. And I envied Hobart for being able to love what he did, because he had the freedom to do it the way he wanted to, and because the now-defunct Katz's chewing tobacco people couldn't have cared less what he painted next to their logo. Oh, for such benign indifference when it came to my work. But I also pitied Hobart, because letting go of what you've come to love is a hard, hard thing, which makes the lending of that creative, loving process all the harder to take, especially when the ending is an involuntary thing. What had the old man said in the TV interview? That he was too old to climb the ladder anymore? That had to have been as bad as him realizing that he couldn't drive safely anymore. And the funny thing was, I got the feeling that if he could have climbed those ladders, he would have still been putting those man-sized cats on barns, whether Katz's paid him or not. I honestly couldn't say the same thing about what I did for a living. I was in the middle of shooting a series of pictures for a new women's cologne, which happened to come in a bottle that resembled a piece of industrial flotsam, more than a container for a fragrance, boasting top notes of green with cinnamon undercurrents, whatever that meant, since the stuff smelled like dime store deodorant, when my studio phone rang. I had the answering machine on call screening, so I could hear it while not missing out on my next shot. But I hurried to the phone when a tentative-sounding voice asked,
Are you the one who dropped Mr. Gurney off at the home a couple of months ago?
Yeah, you're speaking to me, not the machine. The woman on the other end began without preamble.
Sorry to bother you, but we found your card in Mr. Gurney's room. The last anyone saw of him, he was carrying that album you give him under his arm before he went for his walk. Only he never went for a walk for a week before.
The sick feeling began in my stomach and soon fanned out all over my body as the woman in charge of the old people's home rambled on, telling me that no one in the area had seen the old man after he'd accepted a lift from someone with Canadian plates on his car, which naturally meant that he could be anywhere, but maybe headed for New York. I shook my head, even though the woman couldn't possibly see me, as I cut in, "No, ma'am. Don't even try looking here. He's not far away, I'm sure of it. If he's not still in Little Egypt, He's across the border in Kentucky. Just look for the Katz's tobacco signs.
The what?
I pressed the receiver against my chest, muttered, "You stupid old biddy," just to make myself feel better, then told her, "He painted signs on barns. He's saying goodbye to the signs." And as I said the last few words, I wondered at my own choice of words, even as my own artist's instincts Gurney and I shared, told me that I had indeed chosen my words correctly. Despite the fact that the woman from the rest home had gotten her information from me, she never bothered to call me back when Hobart Gurney's body was found, half buried in the unmown grass surrounding one of the abandoned barns bearing his loving handiwork. I found out about his death along with all the other people watching CNN that late fall evening. The network reran the piece about his last or next-to-last sign-painting job, along with an oddly sentimental obituary that ended with a close-up of the little girls whose particular sign the old man's body had been found under. The camera zoomed in for a close-up of Mish Mish, with her patchwork face of mixed tan and gray and white, with that peach-colored blotch over one eye. And she looked so poignant, yet so real, that no one watching her, be they a cat lover or not, could fail to realize what may have been more difficult to realize during that warts-and-all initial CNN interview, which plainly showed how unsophisticated and gauche Hobart Gurney may have seemed to be on the outside. So much so, perhaps, that it made underestimating his work all the easier. That Gurney was more than a great artist. He was a genius, easily on the par of Grandma Moses or anyone of her ilk. J.C. Suarez was the first person to put out a book devoted to Katz's cats, as Gurney's creations were to become popularly known. Many famous photographers, including Herb Ritz, Annie Leibovitz, and Avedon, took in that collection. I wasn't one of them, but I did get on that other collection put together for one of the AIDS charities. Then came the specials on what Gurney would have called the art fart stations. And there's even been word of a postage stamp bearing his likeness, along with one of the Katz's cats. The irony was, I seriously doubt Gurney would have truly enjoyed all the fuss made about his work. What he'd created was too private for all that. Not when he'd so lovingly stroked the images of his little girls' faces in that rental car of mine. And not when he'd so spontaneously shared that cat-sized dream of his from his barn-mucking boyhood so many years and barn cats ago. But at least for me, there was one benefit from his life and his work becoming so public. It gave me an opportunity to find out what really happened to him, without my needing to visit that depressing small town where I'd met him, or to actually see his all but empty cell-like adult daycare bedroom. Some policemen found his body, almost covered by long dead grass, just below the barn where he'd painted the little girls. He was curled on his left side, almost in a fetal position, with both hands covering his face, not unlike a cat at sleep or rest. Supposedly it was a heart attack, but that didn't account for the abrasions on his exposed face and hands. A rough, red, rash-like disruption on his flesh, which was eventually dismissed as fire ant bites. Nor did the official cause of death account for the blissful look on his face that the policeman in one A&E special described. You don't have to be a doctor to know that heart attacks are painful. Nor do you need to be an expert on cats, especially big cats, to know what a cat's tongue can do to unprotected flesh, especially when they get it into their heads to keep licking and licking while snuggled together in a pile of warm, furry flesh. Maybe Hobart Gurney didn't mean to say goodbye, per se, during that self-prescribed tour of his creations. Maybe he'd just grown nostalgic after seeing the pictures I'd given to him. Funny how he took the album with him, when he'd never forgotten a single cat he'd created. But then again, no one will ever know what drove him to turn a Depression-era job taken despite an aversion to heights into something more than his life's work. Perhaps my decision to collect photographs of his work ultimately led to his death, which I heard about on the CNN news. But if that is so, I can't quite feel guilty about it. After all, Gurney hadn't painted cats in years. True, Nothing stopped him from painting them on canvas. But I don't think that was Gurney's way at all. Hadn't he said that what he was doing was work? Something he was supposed to be doing? I doubt that notion of painting for himself applied to his practical mind, just as I doubt that he could have foreseen a day when his cats would be severed from the very barns on which they lived, to be taken in wall-sized chunks and domesticated in museums and art galleries all over the country. Or maybe he did have an inkling of what would happen, and knew that he wouldn't have his cats to himself for very much longer. And considering what was written on his tombstone, by whom, I don't know. I don't think I'm the only person who maybe knows what really happened to Hobart Gurney, down in the long, dead, flattened grass below the little girls. For this is what is carved on his barn-gray tombstone. No heaven will not ever heaven be, unless my cats are there to welcome me. All I can say is, I hope it was warm, and soft, and loving, there in the long, dead grass, with the little girls. In memory of Beanie, Ming, Fella, Ollie, Stan, Puddin, Blackie, Cupcake, Smokey, Prissy, Mishmish, Dewey, Rusty, Precious, Puff, Lucky, Eric, Sweetheart, Jack, Early Gray, Charlie, Dolly, Maynard, Willie, Gwyn, Leia, Spunky, Belle, Stripes, Boo, Moo Moo, Bruiser, Monkey, Goldie, Paco, Butterball, Spooky, Silky, Ladybug, Orangey, Coco, Frosty, Simba, Rosie, Mrs. T, Mr., Muffin, Bubba, Speedy, Whiskers, Bitsy, Purr Bear, K2, Chloe, Bippy, Brutus, Teddy, Amelia, Elmo, Alfie, Gloria, Woody, Jezebel, Tigger, Pansy, Oscar, April, Pioki, Meg, Adrian, Sylvester, Baby, Marco Polo, Lovely, Candy, Lola, Lacey, Poopy, Violet, Queenie, Otto, Babykins, Mama Cat, Cutie Pie, Sandy, Beauty, Sean, Chewy, Scooter, Mittens, Taffy, Boo Boo, Clyde, Bailey, Gummidge, Dundee, Chatty, Princess, Pinky, Apollo, Amber, Denise, Callie, Bijou, Squeaky, Cece, Felix, Boogie, Little Boy, Sugar Plum, Tweety Pie, Ruby, Penny, Fluffy 2, Pumpkin, Casper, Boots, Jet, Honey, Bo, Angel, Mac, Bugsy, Miss Kitty, Katie, Junebug, Cinnamon, Tippy, Gracie, Quinn, Grady, Trudy, Baby Biscuit, May, and Mongo. The Price. Neil Gaiman.
Neil Gaiman is the Newbery-winning author of The Graveyard Book and a New York Times bestseller whose books have been made into major motion pictures, including the recent Coraline. He is also famous for the Sandman graphic novel series and for numerous other books and comics for adult, young adult, and younger readers. He has won the Hugo, Nebula, Mythopoeic, World Fantasy, and other awards. He is also the author of powerful short stories and poems. The Price is a lovely, mystical, powerful, and moving tale that Gaiman admits is also more or less true. At least, the narrator in this story is pretty much me. The house is my house, the cats my cats, and the family is my family. The black cat was just as I have described him.
Tramps and vagabonds of marks they make on gateposts and trees and doors, letting others of their kind know a little about the people who live at the houses and farms they pass on their travels. I think cats must leave similar signs. How else to explain the cats who turn up at our door throughout the year, hungry and flea-ridden and abandoned? We take them in. We get rid of the fleas and the ticks, feed them and take them to the vet. We pay for them to get their shots, and indignity upon indignity, we have them neutered or spayed. And they stay with us for a few months, or for a year, or forever. Most of them arrive in summer. We live in the country, just the right distance out of town for the city dwellers to abandon their cats near us. We never seem to have more than 8 cats, rarely have less than 3. The cat population of my house is currently as follows. Hermione and Pod, Tabby and Black, respectively. The mad sisters who live in my attic office and do not mingle. Princess, the blue-eyed, long-haired white cat, who lived wild in the woods for years before she gave up her wild ways for soft sofas and beds. And last but largest, Furball, Princess's cushion-like calico long-haired daughter, orange and black and white, whom I discovered as a tiny kitten in our garage one day, strangled and almost dead, her head poked through an old badminton net, and who surprised us all by not dying, but instead growing up to be the best-natured cat I have ever encountered. And then there is the black cat, who has no other name than the Black Cat, and who turned up almost a month ago. We did not realize he was going to be living here at first. He looked too well fed to be a stray, too old and jaunty to have been abandoned. He looked like a small panther, and he moved like a patch of night. One day in the summer, he was lurking about our ramshackle porch, 8 or 9 years old at a guess, male, greenish-yellow of eye, very friendly, quite unperturbable. I assumed he belonged to a neighboring farmer or household. I went away for a few weeks to finish writing a book, and when I came home he was still on our porch, living in an old cat bed one of the children had found for him. He was, however, almost unrecognizable. Patches of fur had gone, and there were deep scratches on his gray skin. The tip of one ear was chewed away. There was a gash beneath one eye, a slice gone from one lip. He looked tired and thin. We took the black cat to the vet, where we got him some antibiotics, which we fed him each night, along with soft cat food. We wondered who he was fighting. Princess, our white, beautiful, near feral queen, raccoons, a rat-tailed fanged possum. Each night the scratches would be worse. One night his side would be chewed up. The next, it would be his underbelly, raked with claw marks and bloody to the touch. When it got to that point, I took him down to the basement to recover, beside the furnace and the piles of boxes. He was surprisingly heavy, the black cat, and I picked him up and carried him down there with a cat basket, and a litter bin, and some food and water. I closed the door behind me. I had to wash the blood from my hands when I left the basement. He stayed down there for 4 days. At first he seemed too weak to feed himself. A cut beneath one eye had rendered him almost one-eyed, and he limped and lolled weakly, thick yellow pus oozing from the cut in his lip. I went down there every morning and every night, and I fed him, and gave him antibiotics, which I mixed with his canned food, and I dabbed at the worst of the cuts, and spoke to him. He had diarrhea, and although I changed his litter daily, the basement stank evilly. The 4 days that the black cat lived in the basement were a bad 4 days in my house. The baby slipped in the bath and banged her head and might have drowned. I learned that a project I had set my heart on, adapting Hope Merley's novel Lude in the Mist for the BBC, was no longer going to happen, and I realized that I did not have the energy to begin again from scratch, pitching it to other networks or to other media. My daughter left for summer camp and immediately began to send home a plethora of heart-tearing letters and cards, 5 or 6 each day, imploring us to take her away. My son had some kind of fight with his best friend, to the point that they were no longer on speaking terms, and returning home one night, my wife hit a deer, who ran out in front of the car. The deer was killed, the car was left undrivable, and my wife sustained a small cut over one eye. By the 4th day, the cat was prowling the basement, walking haltingly but impatiently between the stacks of books and comics, the boxes of mail and cassettes, of pictures and of gifts and of stuff. He mewed at me to let him out, and reluctantly I did so. He went back onto the porch and slept there for the rest of the day. The next morning there were deep, new gashes in his flanks, and clumps of black cat hair, his, covered the wooden boards of the porch. Letters arrived that day from my daughter, telling us that camp was going better, and she thought she could survive a few days. My son and his friend sorted out their problem, although what the argument was about, trading cards, computer games, Star Wars, or a girl, I would never learn. The BBC executive who had vetoed Lude in the Mist was discovered to have been taking bribes, well, questionable loans, from an independent production company, and was sent home on permanent leave. His successor, I was delighted to learn, when she faxed me, was the woman who had initially proposed the project to me before leaving the BBC. I thought about returning the black cat to the basement, but decided against it. Instead, I resolved to try and discover what kind of animal was coming to our house each night, and from there to formulate a plan of action, to trap it, perhaps. For birthdays and at Christmas, my family gives me gadgets and gizmos, pricey toys which excite my fancy but ultimately rarely leave their boxes. There is a food dehydrator and an electric carving knife, a bread-making machine and last year's present, a pair of see-in-the-dark binoculars. On Christmas Day, I had put the batteries into the binoculars and had walked about the basement in the dark, too impatient even to wait until nightfall, stalking a flock of imaginary starlings. You were warned not to turn it on in the light. That would have damaged the binoculars, and quite possibly your eyes as well. Afterwards, I had put the device back into its box, and it sat there still, in my office, beside the box of computer cables and forgotten bits and pieces. Perhaps, I thought, if the creature, dog or cat or raccoon or what have you, were to see me sitting on the porch, it would not come. So I took a chair into the box and coat room, little larger than a closet, which overlooks the porch, and when everyone in the house was asleep, I went out onto the porch and bade the black cat good night. That cat, my wife had said, when he first arrived, is a person, and there was something very person-like in his huge leonine face, his broad black nose, his greenish-yellow eyes, his fanged but amiable mouth, still leaking amber pus from the right lower lip. I stroked his head and scratched him beneath the chin and wished him well. Then I went inside and turned off the light on the porch. I sat on my chair in the darkness inside the house, with the see-in-the-dark binoculars on my lap. I had switched the binoculars on, and a trickle of greenish light came from the eyepieces. Time passed in the darkness. I experimented with looking at the darkness with the binoculars, learning to focus, to see the world in shades of green. I found myself horrified by the number of swarming insects I could see in the night air. It was as if the night world were some kind of nightmarish soup, swimming with life. Then I lowered the binoculars from my eyes and stared out at the rich blacks and blues of the night, empty and peaceful and calm. Time passed. I struggled to keep awake, found myself profoundly missing cigarettes and coffee. My two lost addictions. Either of them would have kept my eyes open. But before I had tumbled too far into the world of sleep and dreams, a yowl from the garden jerked me fully awake. I fumbled the binoculars to my eyes, and was disappointed to see that it was merely Princess, the white cat, streaking across the front garden like a patch of greenish-white light. She vanished into the woodland to the left of the house, and was gone. I was about to settle myself back down, when it occurred to me to wonder what exactly had startled Princess so, and I began scanning the middle distance with the binoculars, looking for a huge raccoon, a dog, or a vicious possum. And there was indeed something coming down the driveway, toward the house. I could see it through the binoculars, clear as day. It was the devil. I had never seen the devil before, and although I had written about him in the past, if pressed, would have confessed that I had no belief in him, other than as an imaginary figure, tragic and Miltonian. The figure coming up the driveway was not Milton's Lucifer. It was the devil. My heart began to pound in my chest, to pound so hard that it hurt. I hoped it could not see me, that in a dark house behind window glass, I was hidden. The figure flickered and changed as it walked up the drive. One moment it was dark, bull-like, minotaurish. The next it was slim and female, and the next it was a cat itself, a scarred, huge gray-green wild cat, its face contorted with hate. There are steps that lead up to my porch, four white wooden steps in need of a coat of paint. I knew they were white, although they were, like everything else, green through my binoculars. At the bottom of the steps, the devil stopped and called out something that I could not understand. Three, perhaps four words in a whining, howling language that must have been old and forgotten when Babylon was young. And although I did not understand the words, I felt the hairs raise on the back of my head as it called. And then I heard, muffled through the glass, but still audible, a low growl, a challenge, and slowly, unsteadily, a black figure walked down the steps of the house, away from me, toward the devil. These days the black cat no longer moved like a panther. Instead he stumbled and rocked, like a sailor only recently returned to land. The devil was a woman now. She said something soothing and gentle to the cat, in a tongue that sounded like French, and reached out a hand to him. He sank his teeth into her arm, and her lip curled, and she spat at him. The woman glanced up at me then, and if I had doubted that she was the devil before, I was certain of it now. The woman's eyes flashed red fire at me, but you can see no red through the night vision binoculars, only shades of a green. And the devil saw me through the window. It saw me. I am in no doubt about that at all. The devil twisted and writhed, and now it was some kind of jackal, a flat-faced, huge-headed, bull-necked creature, halfway between a hyena and a dingo. There were maggots squirming in its mangy fur, and it began to walk up the steps. The black cat leapt upon it, and in seconds they became a rolling, writhing thing, moving faster than my eyes could follow. All this in silence. And then a low roar. Down the country road at the bottom of our drive in the distance, lumbered a late-night truck, its blazing headlights burning bright as green suns through the binoculars. I lowered them from my eyes and saw only darkness and the gentle yellow of headlights, and then the red of rear lights as it vanished off again into the nowhere at all. When I raised the binoculars once more, there was nothing to be seen, only the black cat on the steps, staring up into the air. I trained the binoculars up and saw something flying away, a vulture perhaps, or an eagle, and then it flew beyond the trees and was gone. I went out onto the porch and picked up the black cat and stroked him and said kind, soothing things to him. He mewled piteously when I first approached him, but after a while he went to sleep on my lap, and I put him into his basket and went upstairs to my bed to sleep myself. There was dried blood on my t-shirt and jeans the following morning. That was a week ago. The thing that comes to my house does not come every night, but it comes most nights. We know it by the wounds on the cat, and the pain I can see in those leonine eyes. He has lost the use of his front paw, and his right eye has closed for good. I wonder what we did to deserve the black cat. I wonder who sent him. And selfish and scared, I wonder how much more he has to give. Dark Eyes, Faith, and Devotion. Charles DeLint.
Charles DeLint is a full-time writer and musician who presently makes his home in Ottawa, Canada, with his wife, Mary Ann Harris, an artist and musician. His most recent books are Widdershins, Promises to Keep, Dingo, and The Mystery of Grace. Other recent publications include the collections The Hour Before Dawn, Triskel Tales 2, and Muse and Reverie. For more information about his work, visit his website at www.charlesdelint.com. Many of DeLint's short stories take place in the fictional city of Newford, and Dark Eyes, Faith, and Devotion is one of them. In it, an atypical taxi driver provides an atypical favor for one of his fares, with unexpected results.
I've just finished cleaning the vomit my last fare left in the back seat. His idea of a tip, I guess, since he actually shortchanged me a couple of bucks. And I'm back cruising, when the woman flags me down on Gracie Street, outside one of those girl-on-girl clubs. I'll tell you, I'm as open-minded as the next guy, but it breaks my heart when I see a looker like this playing for the other team. She's enough to give me sweet dreams for the rest of the week, and this is only Monday night. She's about 5'7 or 5'8 and dark-skinned, Hispanic maybe, or Indian, I can't tell. I just know she's gorgeous. jet black hair hanging straight down her back, and she's all decked out in net stockings, spike heels, and a short black dress that looks like it's been sprayed on and glistens like satin. Somehow she manages to pull it off without looking like a hooker. It's got to be her baby doll face, made up to a T, but so innocent all you want to do is keep her safe and take care of her. After you've slept with her, mind. I watch her in the rearview mirror as she gets into the back seat, showing plenty of leg with that short dress of hers, and not shy about my seeing it. We both know that's all I'm getting, and I'm lucky to get that much. She wrinkles her nose, and I can't tell if it's some linger of Lou de Puke, or the Lysol I sprayed on the seat after I cleaned up the mess my last fare left behind. Hell, maybe it's me. What can I do for you, ma'am? I ask. She's got these big, dark eyes, and they fix on mine in the rearview mirror, just holding on to my gaze like we're the only two people in the world.
How far are you willing to go?
She asks. Dressed like she is, you'd be forgiven for thinking it was a come-on. Hell, that was my first thought, anyway. Doesn't matter she's playing on that other team. But there's that cherub innocence thing she's got going for her, and, well, take a look at a pug like me. And you know the one thing that isn't going to happen is some pretty girl's going to make a play for me from the back seat of my cab. I can take you any place you need to go, I tell her, playing it safe.
And if I need something else?
She asks. I shake my head. I don't deal with anything that might put me inside. I almost said back inside. But that's not something she needs to know. Though maybe she already does. Maybe when I pulled over she saw the prison tattoos on my arms. You know, you put them on with a pen and the ink from a ballpoint, so they always come out looking kind of scratchy and blue.
Someone has stolen my cat, she says. I was hoping you might help me get her back.
I turn right around in my seat to look at her straight on. I decide she's Hispanic from her accent. I like the Spanish warmth it puts on her words. Your cat, I say. You mean like a pet?
Something like that. I really do need someone to help me steal her back.
I laugh. I can't help it. So what? You flag down the first cab you see and figure whoever's driving it'll take a short break from cruising for fares to help you creep some joint?
Creep?
She asks. Break in. But quietly, you know, because you're hoping you won't get caught. She shakes her head.
No,
she says.
I just thought you might.
And that would be because...
You've got kind eyes.
People have said a lot of things about me over the years, but that's something I've never heard before. It's like telling a wolf he's got a nice smile. I've been told I've got dead eyes, or a hard stare, but no one's ever had anything nice to say about them before. I don't know if it's because of that, or if it's because of that innocence she carries that just makes you want to take care of her, but I find myself nodding. Sure, I tell her. Why not? It's a slow night. Where can we find this cat of yours?
First, I need to go home and get changed, she says. I can't go. What was the word you used?
She smiles.
Creep a house wearing this.
Well, she could, I think. And it would sure make it interesting for me if I was hoisting her up to a window. But I just nod again. No problem, I tell her. Where do you live? This whole situation would drive Hank crazy. We did time together a while back. We'd each pulled a stretch and they ran in tandem for a few years. It's all gangs inside now, and since we weren't either of us black or Indian or Hispanic, and we sure as hell weren't going to run with the Aryans, we ended up passing a lot of the time with each other. He told me to look him up when I got out and he'd fix me up. A lot of guys say that, but they don't mean it. You're trying to do good and you want some hard case showing up at your home or place of employment? I don't think so. So I wouldn't have bothered, but Hank never said something unless he meant it. And since I really did want to take a shot at walking the straight and narrow this time, I took him up on it. He hooked me up with this guy named Moth who runs a gypsy cab company out of a junkyard. You know, the wheels aren't licensed, but so long as no one looks too hard at the piece of bureaucratic paper stuck on the back of the driver's seat, it's the kind of thing you can get away with. You just make a point of cruising for fares in the parts of town that the legit cabbies prefer to stay out of. So, Hank gave me the break to make good, and Moth laid one piece of advice on me. Don't get involved with your fares. And I've been doing okay, keeping my nose clean, making enough to pay for a room in a boarding house, even stashing a little extra cash away on the side. Funny thing is, I like this gig. I'm not scared to take the rough fares, and I'm big enough that the freaks don't mess with me. Occasionally, I even get someone like the woman I picked up on Gracie Street. None of which explains why I'm parked outside a house across town on Merritt Street, getting ready to bust in and rescue a cat. My partner in crime is sitting in the front with me now. Her name's Luisa Jaramillo. She's changed into a tight black t-shirt with a pair of baggy faded jean overalls, black high tops on her feet. Most of her makeup's gone, and her hair's hidden under a baseball cap turned backwards. She still looks gorgeous. Maybe more than she did before. What's your cat's name? I ask.
Patience.
I shrug. That's okay. You don't have to tell me.
No, that's her name,
Luisa says.
Patience.
And this guy that stole her is...
My ex-boyfriend. My very recent ex-boyfriend.
That's what I get for jumping to conclusions, I think. Hell, I was cruising Gracie Street. That doesn't automatically put me on the other team either. Only don't get me wrong. I'm not getting my hopes up or anything. I know I'm just a pug and all she's doing is using me for this